Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest has written a new book which takes on a pretty minuscule topic, the future of civilization. Not much to see here. More specifically, the future of our cities. Jonathan F.P. Rose's new book is called The Well-Tempered City, What Modern Science, Ancient Civilizations, and Human Nature Teach Us About the Future of Urban Life. In the book, Rose lays out a vision for what we need to do to prepare for issues like climate change, income inequality, aging, housing, and pretty much a ton more, which I did not even mention. The great part of the book is that Rose looks to the past to find solutions for the future. Jonathan F.P. Rose is my guest tonight at the big table. Jonathan, thanks for being here.
Justin, so great to be here with you.
All right, let's talk about this. I mean, this is interesting because I really do feel like a lot of the book is about looking to the past to engage and to inform the future.
Right. My goal is actually even to inspire the future, because many of the world's earliest cities were quite inspirational. They had big visions. They had huge visions for what they wanted to become. And I've actually seen that part of what leads to the better or less success of cities today is how big is their vision for themselves.
So visions. I mean, and you talk about in the book, too, as I mentioned in the headline, the idea of modern science and also just our human makeup as a society. But one of the things that is tough is for us to be able to look long term and be able to see some of these problems and fix them when we're dealing with problems in the short term.
Right. One of the reasons to look to the past is because we can look at long-term as it occurred through the past. And one of the things you see is that there are very, very few cities that have predominance for more than 200, 300, 400 years. They all rise and fall. But the other thing about the future is, with big data, we now actually have the ability to take an enormous amount of information coming out of simultaneously from cities. So we could look at traffic information, housing information, environmental impacts, climate change, health information, educational attainment, all the things that we may aspire for to make a better city. And we can actually look at the things we're doing, the interventions we're doing, and in real time see where we're going, do scenario planning and long-range strategic plans. So we have better control over cities than we ever had before.
Is that something we're going to use? And I also would just ask curiously, I mean, does it make that a better outcome for what might be in the future than some of the ancient civilizations where they didn't have access to computers and data and things of that nature? Some of the situations turned out pretty well.
In many cases, they did turn out well because they had a big vision and they actually had a sense of purpose. Early cities were all formed around a temple, and that temple's purpose was to align humans in nature. It was to be, and they're often on what they considered sacred spots.
Yeah.
And so there was to be really this nexus of harmony. In fact, in the Chinese cities, the harmony was an implicit responsibility of the emperor and a key to the design of the cities. Having that larger purpose, they're always attuned to, are we getting more in harmony with nature or less? And that is something we are not doing today.
And it's not just lip service, because you talked about in the book, just even at the beginning, the concept that populations in urban landscapes here in this country around the world are exploding. I mean, it used went from, I can't remember the numbers, but it's just like 70-75% in years.
So we were, the global population was a billion in 1900. And by 2050, it's supposed to stabilize at about 10 billion. The population is also becoming more prosperous. The good thing is people around the world are moving out of poverty, but they're consuming a lot more, and that creates a big resource demand. And obviously, they pollute more as they consume more. We're seeing a rise in income inequality, and the world is rapidly urbanizing. So 80% of the world's population is moving to cities. What you're seeing is what we learned from history is that when you have climate change, large population growth, overconsumption of resources, and income inequality, when the climate changes, as it did naturally throughout time, you often had collapse. You almost always had collapse, because the climate change typically would bring things like drought, and cities often grew to the very edge of their resources, say their water supply. So if you design a city for a million people and the water supply can only supply 800,000 or 700,000 because of a drought, those 200,000 people who all of a sudden are not being taken care of, if it's an unequal society and there is not a sense of altruism that reaches down and takes care of everybody, they revolt.
There's something to be said about all the things you just mentioned are part of the current recipe of how we live. Are planners, yourself, others, leaders, are we looking to history and we looking and saying, oh, we're at the point where we stretch resources to the edge?
There are many thinkers who are saying that, but the day-to-day urban planners, I don't see it happening. I mean, I should rephrase that. There's a growing sense of resilience, but in most cities, the day-to-day urban planners are so overwhelmed with the issues of current needs of affordable housing and all the zoning applications and all the neighborhood issues that they often don't have time to step back and really think big. And when they do, we're seeing cities do plans like 2030 plans, 2020 plans. Mm-hmm. So these are 15, 20, 25 years maybe in advance. But we're not seeing people, the cities do 2100 plans or plans to 2200.
I can't even imagine. I think this is important to say. I mean, you talk about urban life. And someone who might be listening right now, say, in the western suburbs or someone even in McHenry County, say, well, you know, the cities, they're going to have problems, not us out here. That's not what you're talking about. You're talking about urbanizing in the way that includes a region, not just the city, but the suburbs, everything included.
Exactly. I use the word city because it's a more – it's easier one to read and say. But in fact, we mean metropolitan regions. And there are many interesting things happening in the suburbs. The first is there is now more suburban poverty in America than urban poverty. In fact, urban conditions are getting better and better. More reinvestment in cities. Their jobs are coming back to cities. Suburban areas, are many suburban areas, not all, are actually having a tougher time. The second thing is that we are seeing an urbanization of the suburbs. We're seeing the growth of town centers, particularly around train station stops, where there were traditional town centers.
We see that here all over Chicago.
And what we're seeing is that younger families really want to be located in those town centers. They want to be walk to the great restaurants and all the amenities of downtowns. Mm-hmm. We're seeing around the country much more multifamily housing being built in those centers. So the ones that actually can create a walkable, mixed-income, mixed-use center with transit in the middle of it are thriving. The ones that are steeped in enormous traffic and are disparate and don't have a sense of place are often, not in every case, but often not doing as well.
So much to talk about. Let's take a break. We'll come back and we'll start with the past. I'm interested in how some of these civilizations were able to tackle the same problems that we're tackling today. Jonathan F.P. Rose is the author of The Well-Tempered City, What Modern Science, Ancient Civilizations, and Human Nature Teach Us About the Future of Urban Life. He's my guest at the big table. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest in the studio, he is the author of The Well-Tempered City, What Modern Science, Ancient Civilizations, and Human Nature Teach Us About the Future of Urban Life, Jonathan F.P. Rose. I really want to talk about the city ecosystem, the concept of where cities came from. I mean, as we look back in human civilization, you think that everything is either caves or strange, like you said, almost like organized around temple, but not really how we know cities to be today, and that's completely false. There were a lot of cities and urban environments at the beginnings of human civilization.
So what was interesting is the very first buildings were actually temples, and that's and there were some amazing, huge temples with incredible sculptures, and they may not have even been huts at that time, but people got together to build these temples. And then they began building towns, and the towns were often gathered around a temple. And as technology advanced and people began to create more interesting things, they began to trade with each other. If everybody had the same thing, there's nothing to trade.
Right.
And the trade formed what actually archaeologists at University of Chicago call an interaction zone. So you began to get this network effect of connectivity. And as there's more trade, there's more prosperity, more people moving to these towns, and the towns began to grow. So the emergence of the city wasn't a single phenomenon like all of a sudden there's one great city. It was this network phenomena where throughout the Middle East, more and more towns grew. They were trading. They're actually trading across distances.
And that's I think the area wasn't necessarily just one city, but area, the Ubaid, that's the first, as we know it, of human civilization where it became almost like a city.
Well, so these towns grew larger and larger, and then they came with what they called proto-cities. But then the first real city was called Ubaid, and it was about 3200 BC. And there are models. You can actually go online and see models of it. And it was built out of stone and substantial buildings and palaces and temples, and it was a real significant city. And by the mid 2500s BCs in the Middle East, 90% of the people lived actually in cities. There were huge I call cities cauldrons of opportunity. People move to cities for because they think their lives can be better there.
You know, as you mentioned in the first segment about the idea that resources got stretched thin as cities got bigger and bigger and got towards the edges. For a place like Ubaid, was it same? Were they dealing with the same issues we're dealing with today? When you talk about climate change, obviously building in the desert, talking about income inequality and the other issues that big cities in this country and around the world are dealing with?
That's part of human nature, and they did have to deal with them. But they were actually, interestingly, although they had very wealthy, they had emperors and people who led them, but they were fairly equal. And the way we know this is because the house sizes were pretty much the same. And this is a really interesting thing, is that people are very sensitive to fairness in cities and whether the system is fair or not. And the original temples were actually also the storehouses. They were the places that people trusted to bring their grain and their precious things to store, and that they would be safe kept and fairly redistributed. And people understood that fair redistribution meant you didn't always get back all that you put in. It was to take care of the whole society. As a matter of fact, in 1752 BC, Hammurabi, who's the head of Babylonia, a vast empire, and he has the first real code we know, the Code of Hammurabi. And one of the key lines is, he said, my job is to oversee the fair distribution of goods, to protect the weak from the strong, to protect the widows and orphans, to see that justice is done throughout the land, and to provide for the welfare of all of mankind.
Well, there's something to be said about human civilization and the struggle, and there have been different names, as you just mentioned there, but different names of the concept of socialism versus capitalism, this concept of we need to protect everybody and make sure it's fair, as opposed to I'm going to get mine and we're going to build and I'm going to get wealthy off of this. This is not something that is happening just here in Chicago or New York City, but this is something that goes all the way, dates back to BC time.
As I said, people move to cities for opportunity, and opportunity is a me thing. It's about I want to make my world better, my family better, grow my wealth. But cities thrive because of we-ness. There is a fantastic, originally Chicago-based sociologist named Robert Sampson who compared all the neighborhoods of Chicago, and he said there's a factor called collective efficacy, and you can actually track the prosperity of neighbors and compare it to this factor. And collective efficacy is the ability of people to work together to achieve a communal outcome. And it's not only the achieving the outcome, it's the belief that if you work together, you will succeed. So we know that the communities in which there's a sense that we're all in it together ultimately are much more resilient and thrive much better in times of crises. So, for example, the Mayan civilization. So here we're, you know, now in the early 500, 600, 700 AD, and fantastic civilization is growing. But it was very unequal. And when climate change hit and its water resources shrunk, the people who were this not only just the slaves, the people who the society was not taking well care of, felt abused and about the unfairness of the distribution of goods, and they burnt the civilization down in revolt.
It's such a fascinating look at the way that we live as humans, but also just about urban planning and long term. You think about one of the things that I, as we switch to a more current time, you think of the way that American cities were built, and you think of New York City or Philadelphia, but even 500 years before that, 400 years, and people never talk about the Iroquois and the city that they called Cahokia, which is now St. Louis, was the first major city in the United States.
There were actually vast Native American cities in the United States, quite extensive. They had a much more urban culture, and we destroyed it. One of the things that happened is the Europeans brought diseases with them, and so many of the populations before the Europeans really got there, the populations had already died from smallpox. They didn't fully understand what was here.
There's so much in this book, so much to talk about. Let's take a break and an update on tonight's news. When we come back, I'd love to talk about how we as a nation view cities in our lifetimes, in the 20th century, 21st century. There's a lot that happened that really almost goes against some of the concepts we were just talking about the idea of collective we, and some that actually went with the concept. We'll talk more with Jonathan F.P. Rose. He's the author of The Well-Tempered City, What Modern Science, Ancient Civilizations, and Human Nature Teach Us About the Future of Urban Life. We'll be back. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest at the big table tonight, Jonathan F.P. Rose. He's the author of The Well-Tempered City, What Modern Science, Ancient Civilizations, and Human Nature Teach Us About the Future of Urban Life. Talking about learning from our past to inform and inspire the future. When you talk about urban planning and we talk about cities and urban life, you know, you can look to how it is today based on how some of the policies and I guess politics that went into it even in the early 20th century. Why don't we start with I'm interested in 1922. Herbert Hoover was really into urban planning. It's surprising, but he was really into it, and he really wanted to push the idea of zoning.
So he was actually the Department of Commerce then. He had not yet become president, and he loved the idea of zoning. And he actually wrote something about how it'll make our cities healthier and environmentally better. And I appreciate his appreciation of planning. And the federal government then put out a lot of incentives that required and encouraged states to all adopt the same zoning code. And then the states passed that on to the cities. So cities were not zoned before.
Right.
And there were some very good reasons to protect. So if you lived in a nice residential area and all of a sudden somebody put in a factory, and remember the factories back then were highly polluting, that would destroy your property values, and that would be something you would not like. So zoning was a way to control it. But zoning went too far because it created a whole series of single-use zones. So we said all the factories are going to be
right
here, all the single-family houses are going to be here, all the multifamily housing is going to be here. And what makes cities great is that everything's all woven together.
Yeah, it's mixed, right.
There's a huge amount of complexity. That's what draws people to cities. And the zoning at that point was so single use, it segregated the elements and began in many ways to not only tear the city apart, but to restrict their evolution. So if you had an area that was zoned manufacturing and manufacturing began to decline, as by the way, what happened in most Midwestern cities
including
around
here,
the United
yeah
States, including yeah here, the zoning wouldn't allow something else to take place. The zoning also concentrated pollution.
It also concentrated wealth in a way,
right,
because you'd have zoning for certain types of buildings.
Right.
And they were luxury high-rises,
right,
and that's what we see a lot of, what we see maybe in the Gold Coast
right
here. But you also – a lot of zoning – was manufacturing, and that
right
kept, you know, developers to be able to come in and say, I'm going to add some wealth to this area, because they couldn't.
Exactly. Then a second overlay. In the Depression comes, and in the 1930s, the federal government, to try and encourage home building and home ownership and get the economy back, creates the Federal Housing Authority and starts creating mortgage programs. But the mortgage programs came with an inherent zoning of its own, a racist zoning, in fact. And there were five different colors, the different neighborhoods. So there were maps of every city in America. And a neighborhood that was circled in blue, we put your mortgages here, it's a great place. And there was yellow, green, but there was also red. And neighborhoods that were redlined, that had a red
yeah
around
well
them.
Yeah, we just talked about that on the show, yeah.
The government actually said, you should not lend here. And those were all, first of all, minority neighbors, they're immigrant neighborhoods, they're actually even Jewish and Italian neighborhoods. So those homeowners couldn't get mortgages, so they couldn't invest in improving their homes. People couldn't borrow to buy in those neighborhoods.
What I love about this is, I mean, we learn from history,
yeah,
and we'd go all the way back to
right
BC time, and there was talk about how you develop a city and how
right
everybody lives together in the collective we, and it's almost through politics and policy
right
and the federal government that over time we've seen that deteriorate.
The federal government is not all bad, by the way.
Yeah.
I think it does many wonderful things, too. But what we need are cities that are much more dynamic and that are thriving and have the ability to create opportunity. I actually want to talk about that. And so when you took the zoning and then you took the really racially motivated housing. So if you had a community that housing finance, if you had a community that was restricted by zoning and then people couldn't borrow money to improve, of course that neighborhood was
right
going to decline.
And, you know, we'll fast forward a little
yeah
bit. I mean, obviously the beginning of public housing was
right
was tremendously political.
Right.
The concept was to make a mixed income community, and it was a Republican Congress that said, no, this is just for poor people.
Yeah. So interestingly, the idea of public housing came out of Europe where it was very mixed income. And so that got proposed. And by the way, there was a very important Republican Senator, Robert Taft, who proposed it too. But the home builders, the suburban home builders, the suburban mortgage brokers, the suburban realtors all got together and they said, we don't want the federal government building middle income housing because every time somebody would live in that, they wouldn't buy a home.
Yeah, there's that capitalism, socialism stuff, right?
Well, it's not, you know, the it's not capitalism and socialism, because I run a for-profit company. I'm a believer that capitalism.
Get out, Mr. Rudnow.
I believe that capitalism can do a lot of good things, but in this case, it's lobbying. It's actually lobbying that is the issue. The power of the lobby is so distorted that the Republican Congress said, we will only support federally public housing if it is purely for low-income people. Because anybody could be a customer we don't want to serve.
And at the same time gave mortgage tax.
And at the same time gave all these great mortgage benefits.
Right.
Also only the suburbs. They were actually designed so they didn't work in cities. So all of a sudden you had this unbalance where, in effect, the only federal programs for poor people was public housing, and it concentrated them. And we know how negatively that to Chicago.
It gets glossed over when it comes to what we had here, which was white flight, which was in the 50s. It was after this where there were incentives for people of middle income and the middle class to leave cities to move to suburbs.
So the tremendous economic incentives to leave, like you get a mortgage, which you couldn't get in the city. And there was this concentration of poverty. We now know that mixing incomes really leads to the healthiest communities. But there was another reason people left, and that was the urban school systems began to decline.
Yeah, we didn't talk about that. Right.
So what's interesting is in Finland has the best educational outcomes in the world. And the way they do it is every school is equal. Whether it's the wealthiest neighborhood or the poorest neighborhood, the most Finnish or the most immigrant neighborhood, the outcomes are the same. The school might be different because they have to adjust to different circumstances. The teachers are superbly trained.
How do you do that when we just talked about the construct of lobbying and the construct of making money versus the royal we? How do you do that? How does Finland still be able to do that with all those forces that are at play in the world?
There's an example in the book of Louisville, Kentucky. So this is actually really interesting. It's a comparison of Louisville and Detroit. So 1970, the courts, federal courts rule there has to be a busing and a school integration. And I compare two cities. So Detroit at that time was 80% white, 20% black. The people revolted. The John Birch Society actually burnt school buses. People moved out to the suburbs in droves. There are many reasons why Detroit collapsed, but that was certainly didn't help. And today Detroit is 96% minority. And as we know, Detroit's actually coming back, a very interesting example, but had a failing school system. Louisville, Kentucky, a southern city, actually took the opposite approach. Due to leadership of the Bingham family that owned the newspaper and the radio and TV stations, and the Brown family that owned the largest employer, Brown Foreman, they said, we're all in this together. So this is real civic corporate leadership. And they said, they combined the city and the county school district. So you couldn't move to the county to get away from the schools. And then everybody was this all in it together. So then everybody had a mutual interest in making every school equally as good. Now, they're not all perfect. They're not all equally school, but they're much, much better. They started making magnet schools and spreading them equally around. There are now parents who want their kids bused to the inner city best school. And it worked so well that they eventually merged the city and county government. They merged everything. And that whole region is all one. It has one of the lowest unemployment rates in the country. And the reason why is employers come there and say, these graduates of the school system are superbly educated to be employed for the future.
Jonathan F.P. Rose is the author of The Well-Tempered City. He's my guest. We got about 5 minutes left. And I do want to talk about the five tentpoles for the book. I mean, there really is this. The book is about looking at the problems and what can be the solutions. So let's go over them. I got a sheet here that's got circularity, resilience, community, compassion, and coherence. Why don't we start with coherence?
All right. Coherence, we've talked a lot about segmentation. It's about integrating everything. It's about having, a great vision. And Chicago was one of the first cities in the 20th century to have a great vision, the 1909 Burnham Plan. And by the way, that plan wasn't done by government. It was done by a group of private citizens and business people who pulled it together. So having a great vision and then figuring out how to integrate city departments and programs rather than have them work against each other to achieve that vision.
Not unlike what we just talked about with the idea of we're all in it together, like what's happening in Louisville. All right, circularity.
So circularity is realizing that everything is interconnected. Most cities, actually, if you track them, 98% of the stuff that comes into them leaves as waste within 6 months. So how can we capture that, recycle it? San Francisco has the highest recycling rate in the world, 80%. That actually creates local jobs, reduces pollution. And remember I said the world's going to have a resource crunch coming. It even has in some places. Makes cities more resource independent. And we can take a lot of waste and make construction materials out of it, recycle water and make fresh drinking water.
And it's beyond the concept of recycling saves the planet. This is really about recycling saving the city in the way that we're going to need to do that as resources get strapped.
And it creates jobs, too. So it's a real win-win.
All right. Let's keep moving. Resilience.
Okay. So resilience, we know there are many threats. The world is going to be much more volatile in the 21st century. We saw from the economic crisis, we need economic resilience. But from the human-caused climate change, temperatures are going to rise, sea levels are going to rise, disease vectors, we're going to be seeing Zika everywhere, all due to climate change. Resilience is the adaptive capacity of a city. What's amazing about nature is it has incredible adaptive capacity. If there's a forest fire, nature completely knows how to rebuild itself, you know, to grow back and become a thriving forest again. The cities that are more resilient, and there are a lot of characteristics of resilience, are the ones that do the best. Interestingly, there's not only physical resilience, and we need clean energy systems, smart grids, a whole bunch of things, but there's also social resilience. And one of the best examples happened in 1995 when there was a great heat wave in Chicago and over 700 people died. A sociologist named Eric Kleinenberg mapped that, and what he discovered was that the wealthy white neighborhoods did better than the poor black neighborhoods, but Auburn Gresham did as well as the wealthy white neighbors because of very strong social networks. We've seen that strong social networks and a sense of mutuality, when you look at the great earthquake in San Francisco, et cetera, communities have a sense of mutuality during times of stress, are much more resilient.
All right, community. That's a nice little tie into community.
So community. So what we've learned is that people thrive in communities. I talked earlier about collective efficacy. Communities need seven characteristics to really function. They need affordable housing. They need a great education system, which we talked about, great distributed health care. They need healthy food, and it's great to see that the Whole Foods just opened
up in Inglewood.
Exactly. Yeah. They need diverse transit systems, multiple ways of getting to multiple places, and they need local jobs. They need arts and culture, and they actually need places of spirituality, places for people to reflect. And remember that original role of the temple was to give us a bigger perspective as to who we all are and how we can get there together, vision.
All right, and the last one, compassion.
Right. So what we've learned is that altruism is actually, from an evolutionary point of view, a protective factor, that the tribes that are just always fighting each other and others that says it fail, and the ones in which people collaborate, that's actually what led to human civilization advancement, is our ability to hunt together, to farm together, to grow. Irrigation ditches and systems are the oldest continuously operating democratic form where people decide to how to fairly distribute water. So I'm a big believer in individual entrepreneurialism, but it must be in balance with altruism and the sense that we're all in it together. And you can see that from a lot of science, from a lot of history, and just from the way we feel that when we work together, that's what really makes cities thrive.
It's a fascinating book, The Well-Tempered City, What Modern Science, Ancient Civilizations, and Human Nature Teach Us About the Future of Urban Life. Thank you so much, Jonathan F.P. Rose, for being my guest tonight on The Big Table.
Justin, it's great to be here.